Hello everyone, this is Matt, and welcome to another episode of Takeout with Ashley Coff RD and Robin O'Brien, discussing better, not perfect nutrition and the new food economy. Who's up for a food awakening? Well, today's going to be a great podcast. It's just the fab duo, Ashley and Robin, talking today. And the topic, well, I know it's going to be a popular one. Who's winning the plant-based burger war? Now, I love myself a burger, so I'm very intrigued in this one. Is it Impossible Burger or Beyond Burger? Which one is better for you, better for the planet, the farmers, and even the stock market? So Ashley and Robin, in this episode, pull apart the burgers to assess their health so you can make better choices about what goes into your body. So, looking forward to this one. Beyond Burger or Impossible Burger? Who's going to win? Right, ladies, over to you.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for choosing to grab takeout with Ashley and Robin today. I am Ashley, and this episode is all about takeout. It's all about the number one question that I get in my inbox, and that if I'm anywhere these days, but especially as I'm in the Midwest now and navigating some of these quote unquote fast food places, I'm getting the question: Impossible Burger versus Beyond Meat, which is better? So today we're going to answer that question. We're also going to answer: is it better for farmers? Is it better for Wall Street, right? I think, and is this Beyond Meat versus Impossible Burger discussion even better for the plant-based movement? So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to my podcast partner because, amongst other things, she is a financial and just an overall data. Robin, you're such a data geek. I love it. Like, I love that I can always come to you to be like, what are the numbers saying? So before we get into the numbers of fat and protein percentages and what I think from a health standpoint of which burger is better, let's dive into what is actually going on in the plant-based space so that we can frame where Beyond Burger and the Impossible Burger sit.
Well, what I love about the numbers always is that it tells a story without any emotion. And you want to talk about an emotionally loaded category and space and topic, this one is it. I mean, you get super passionate people on one side that are vegan, that are environmentally concerned about the impact of meat, that are maybe for just dietary reasons trying to opt out or reduce their meat intake on one side. And then you've got equally as passionate people on the other side talking about the incredible need to have meat in the ecosystem to help drive the biodiversity, healthy soils, and everything else. So it can be a very polarizing debate as much as anything politically out there. And when we have something like that, I do always want to turn to the numbers. And I think right now it is absolutely fascinating. $16 billion has been invested in plant-based and cell-cultured meat since 2009. So that's in the last 10 years. $13 billion of that has just been in 2017 and 2018 alone. So this category and this concern and this awakening is absolutely taking off. And I mean, is that on the heels of this United Nations report that came out last October that said, you know, we only have 11 years until this climate crisis is getting to be pretty irreversible? Is it because we're suddenly aware that, you know, with all these epic storms and fires and floods, we really do need to start to pay attention to what's happening to the environment? There are so many reasons. I think another reason that we're starting to see all these alternatives and plant-based is because something I've been talking about for a really, really long time is milk allergy is absolutely on the rise. And so you suddenly have all these consumers that are looking for non-dairy milk and non-dairy products. And that whole space has been absolutely fascinating to follow because we've seen this incredible plummeting of dairy milk sales of $1.1 billion in 2018 alone, according to statistics by the Dairy Farmers of America. And if you think about that, I mean, that's like an 8% drop in dairy milk sales alone in that category. And so consumers are looking for oat milk. They're looking for plant-based milks. They're, you know, we see like this whole category. We were laughing the other day. I mean, you open the fridge in our house and there's regular milk. There is almond milk, there is cashew milk, and there is rice milk. And I mean, growing up, we probably all had pretty similar cartons of milk in our refrigerators. And a report from the USDA revealed that milk consumption has declined by 22% from 2000 to 2016. So with that, you know, what has replaced that is this whole emergence of this plant-based sector. So we saw it first in the milk category, and now we're starting to see it in meat. And it has created an incredible uproar and an incredible amount of capital that has been allocated into this sector. And the two most prominent players and the most prominent figures that we've seen are Beyond Meat, which just IPO'd, and Impossible Foods. What's interesting is that both those companies share pretty similar investor base. And Bill Gates is actually an investor in both. When you step back and you think, okay, we've inherited operating systems in our food system that are failing us. We know that now. What are the new operating systems and what can they look like? And what I would say is usually these first iterations aren't the ones that end up being widely adopted. They are first iterations. They're the first to market, much like IBM computer was. It was the first to market. Is it the most efficient? Is it the smartest? Is it the fastest? In this case, is it the healthiest? Those are the questions that still remain to be answered. And I'm really, really excited, Ashley, that we're going to dig into it today.
Yeah, I love it. And you know, it's so interesting when we think about the decline in dairy, we think about like how cows were being fed soy and corn and how inflammatory that component, like that's just played a role in the health of the cow. And as a result, the lack of health of the cow. And as a result, challenges in their dairy milk. And this whole thing is this massive cycle. And it brings me over to the health question about the Beyond Meat and versus the Impossible Burger, because we aren't necessarily doing anything better here. And I think that's the most important thing. So the number one question, if you ask me which Beyond Meat versus Impossible Burger, I've been a dietitian for 20 years. I love science, just in case anyone's gonna start on the science front. Love science, studied the science. Neither of these are health foods. Now, one could argue that a burger is not a health food, but neither of these are health foods. And I think that's the important piece. So veggie burger. I had actually the most amazing veggie burger the other day here in Columbus, Ohio, up the street. It looked, somebody even said to me, oh my gosh, that looks like a burger. It's like, it's bleeding, like it's pink inside. I asked them how they did it. They did it with beets. And, you know, they had in there some grains and some beans. And then they also had in there some shredded celery. So one of the reasons that one of the key things that we're missing here is like there needs to be something else. What's the other piece in there? And that is that you can have meatless burgers or meatless, entirely meatless, right? So meatless might be the half mushroom, half meat, and the meat completely meatless burger would be the all plants. And they could have all ingredients that we recognize, all ingredients that you would make in the kitchen, all be healthy for you. These burgers are not healthy for you. And I'm going to unpack that further, but I think that's a really important thing for us to understand. So if that's the case, our goal should not be to be investing billions of dollars into something that is not healthy for us. Now, the argument is that it's replacing something that is unhealthy. And I think that's an important piece that you and I will also look into. So why do I say not healthy? Well, first of all, the premise of the Beyond Burger and the Impossible Burger is that we don't need carbohydrates or shouldn't have carbohydrates, or for somebody who's looking for a no carbohydrate option, just a high protein, high fat option. Well, high protein, high fat has gotten us into a lot of problems. Now, there are people who are doing beautifully on keto and paleo and things like that. Your diet still has to be plant-based, but your diet also has to deliver key nutrients. And those nutrients are not here in the forms that we want to be consuming them. So part of like the lack of health is also when I see the communication that the brands are sharing on their websites, you know, I'll look at this. Like, for example, the Impossible Burger was first started out as wheat gluten. And now they've got soy protein concentrate as the second ingredient. The first ingredient is water. So I should say there's a bit of health food in there, right? The first ingredient is water. So soy protein concentrate, this is not organic or non-GMO soy protein. Leave that to whatever you believe about GMOs on that part. If we're just looking at the food on this piece, trading wheat for soy, on their website, they talk about, and in their materials, they talk about how they got rid of an allergen. They didn't get rid of an allergen. They exchanged an allergen here, right? So soy, we know to be an allergen for people. We know that it's irritating for many people from a digestive system standpoint. Now, soy, and especially organic soy, can be great for people. So I don't want to, you know, across the board, but I think it's an important thing that this is not allergen friendly. The other thing is that the list of ingredients, soy protein concentrate, coconut oil, sunflower oil, and then we get into the 2% or less of potato protein, methyl cellulose, yeast extract, and then they add in a bunch of soy protein isolate, and then a bunch of vitamins, no minerals, but a bunch of vitamins. Now, we don't know. I tried everywhere to find the origin of these actual vitamins. This is a common technique that you see in junkier bars and really in a lot of our food. It's the fortification with nutrients in here that belong in a food that you would find in that food in its whole food form, but that we're just throwing in any version of them. So I cannot tell you that the B2, the riboflavin that is in this Impossible Burger is going to work in your body the way that the B2 would from a grain, right? Or likewise, that the mixed tocopherols that you would get in nuts and seeds that are in here, and I like that it's mixed tocopherols, by the way, not just one of the tocopherols, or the B1 that you would be getting those, you know, from other places. So we have to be careful when we just look at dropping in a single nutrient and say, oh, this is a good source, or this is providing the same vitamins or minerals that you would find in a burger. So in the Impossible Burger, I think the main issue from a health standpoint is why it's not healthy is that we're not giving the body anything here that is going to add health value from the way that the body recognizes in a whole food form. Now, if you want to take in soy protein concentrate, my recommendation has always been to get in the actual whole soybean. And the reason for that is soybeans are a rich source of omega-3 fatty acids, which are wonderful for the body for helping to promote a healthy inflammatory response. We also know that soy naturally has fiber in it. So when we start to isolate or concentrate just the protein and we remove these other pieces, that's where we have growing concerns about not just the allergen component, but is the soy going to have the same inflammatory or potentially an unhealthy inflammatory response. Now, all that goes away if you're having like one White Castle Impossible Burger slider. And I guess I should have started off with that. If this is just your treat, go with the one that you like the taste of, or maybe the one that resonates with you from a food tribe standpoint, you know, or any of that piece. But these are not at all something that we should be consuming on a regular basis. So when I look at the health side, excuse me, one more thing on the Impossible Burger, is that in order to make, so one of the things that has been like the most scandalous here, right, and had to go through all sorts of hoops, is that they take the DNA from the soy, something that's in the soy root. It's called leg hemoglobin, to sound like kind of like hemoglobin. And that is, they describe it as inserting it into yeast and then fermenting that yeast. Now, I could be fine with that, right? I could be fine with saying like we're extracting something, we're inserting into yeast and fermenting it. And that really just goes down to if you're okay with genetic engineering or not. But here's where I get really pissed off, because this is no longer just about saying like, hey, this is just something that we're doing. We're not choosing to use beet juice to make it red. We're choosing to go through DNA, you know, extraction of soy and putting it into yeast and fermenting that yeast. But here on their website, they say by making our heme using genetic engineering, we avoid growing and digging up soy plants to harvest the heme from the root nodules, which would promote erosion and release carbon stored into the soil. Hello, basically they just described we're against farming, right? So instead of farming, the method we've adopted enables us to produce heme sustainably at high volume and make meat from plants for millions of people. Hold on. The heme that's in the Impossible Burger is only there to make it bleed, to make that redness occur. So yes, you can make meat for plants for millions of people, delicious, they're saying delicious, nutritious, that I'm arguing with that, and vastly more sustainable. Not really. What you're basically saying here is we've created an ingredient that we can now use in a lot of places that we don't need, because we've already proven we can do this from beet or from other things, but that we're doing this, but it is not adding any health value. So this is at the core of the issue, Robin. And before we go into the Beyond Burger, I want to come back to you on this part. This is at the core of the issue, because what we're doing is we're taking yet again, we're taking from something that could feed America's animals and humans, and we're using it, and we're doing something in a lab now that is just adding color or consistency or texture, but we haven't actually solved any health problem, and we're investing, what did you say, $13 billion so far on this side?
So yeah, you know, but listening to you read that clip from the website about how they don't need to dig up the genetically engineered soy is completely in conflict to what they just announced earlier a couple of weeks ago, is that they are actually going to be using genetically engineered soy as one of the key ingredients in this burger, because what they found was that while they launched with a non-GMO soy, they realized that the supply chain wasn't there. So rather than try to build out the supply chain that was meeting the needs of the 21st century, they just flipped back to the 20th century and went to the cheaper ingredient, which is genetically engineered soy, which is exactly the crop that has resulted in this mass deforestation, because it is the same crop that's used to feed livestock. So, you know, again, there's a lot of hypocrisy that is baked in to the Impossible Burger. And I think for consumers to step back and say, look, is this actually solving a problem, or do we just need to eat less meat? And I was recently asked, you know, well, why, Robin, why is there this this whole kind of meatless thing when we really should be focused on meat reduction? The answer is really, really simple, is that these burger companies have shareholders that are rewarded by the profitability because they have manufactured the demand for these products. There are no shareholders in the meat reduction strategy. So there's no profit to the shareholder there, because we're simply trying to sort of eat more plants, not too much, be very Michael Pollan about this whole thing. What they realized is that they could actually capitalize on it, manufacture this demand for these products. And like you, my concern is that you read the label of these things. This is not a health food. And, you know, some of the companies may argue, well, we never promised to be a health food. I think they are wearing a health halo that they have not earned. And if you were to take the same amount of capital that has been allocated towards these companies and say, look, the infrastructure of America's farm economy is absolutely failing. I was in Nebraska last week, and there are towns that are literally shuttered. There is paper over the windows, and it is such complete heartache. And these are just, this is the lifeblood of America. This is the arteries across America, and they're dead. And I thought, you know, with all of the millions and billions of dollars that are going towards the essentially, this is just processed food, the 21st century version of processed food. What could that have been doing for our farmers that are growing things like chickpeas, our farmers that are growing things like pinto beans, our farmer things that are growing things like peas? And instead of, you know, recreating into a processed food product that you have so clearly articulated present a lot of health risks, to step back and say, you know, how could we actually rebuild the infrastructure of the American farm economy? Because that's what's failing. Less than 1% of our farmland's organic. We're importing something like 80% of the organic products that we consume in this country. And again, that's opportunity for American farmers to capitalize, to grow the American farm economy, to rebuild these towns across Nebraska and Kansas and Iowa. And as I stood on that farm, I thought, you know, how many members of our Congress have actually stood on a farm and listened to a farmer talk about the economics of his business model? And this one particular farmer that we were listening to last Thursday, he said, you know, my family of five only spent $49,000 last year. That was our tax filing, that was our tax return, was $49,000. He was standing in front of a piece of equipment that cost $350,000. And I thought, how in the world does that work? So are we allocating capital efficiently to feed our country, to feed our farm economy, and to rebuild the infrastructure that we need for food security in the United States? And to me, that is the most important conversation here, is this the smartest allocation of capital for the American food system?
Right. And I think in this time, like when we're at this TikTok, like we need solutions. And that's why it really, you know, people can say, oh, there are all sorts of different solutions. But is this a better one? And I want to bring up two points that you mentioned, just to make sure we have full disclosure and clarity, and then we'll move on to the Beyond Burgers. I don't want people to think that we're just talking about the Impossible Burger. When I finished reading, I didn't read the second part that says, we also source genetically engineered soy protein from farms in Iowa, Minnesota, and Illinois that meet the highest standards for health, safety, and sustainability. So they are being very clear that now that their soy is genetically engineered, and I, as a practitioner, want to just make one thing really clear. I think genetic engineering has led to some of the most amazing inventions, you know, whether it's insulin, medication or other things that we are able to do. My knowledge base about genetic engineering and in particular genetically modified organisms, my concern has been, you know, when we change the ripening of an apple, what else are we changing in that apple? Or if we're genetically engineering a salmon to grow much, much more quickly, you know, I know cancer cells are cells that are sped up much more quickly. And so there's just a lot that we don't know. And so calling these things the same thing is unfortunate. But one of the things that we do know is that, and statistically, this has been shown that genetically modified ingredients like soybeans use a higher application of glyphosate. And so the thing that I would want from Impossible Burger is if you want me to be okay, I'm not going to be okay. I don't normally soy protein concentrate or soy protein isolate in a bed of other modified pieces and parts. But if you wanted me to be okay with that, even as a treat, as an occasional thing, I would want you to test your product for glyphosate residue with the Detox Project and find out, you know, is this glyphosate residue free? Because my belief is that if your product is, if the majority, the second ingredient after water is soy protein concentrate, that my belief would be that you would not have that, you would not pass the strict standards there. And I am very passionate, especially for children, for pregnant women, for people who have existing health conditions, to try to reduce their daily consumption of glyphosate residue. So that's one piece that we brought up. So we're disclosing, or we're making clear that we, yes, genetically engineered soy. I think the other part that you mentioned, the health halo, this is one of the things I find the most disturbing, is the Impossible Burger, while sold at places that do have and deserve, in my opinion, a very high regard from a health standpoint, like Bear Burger has both of them. But if you look at where Impossible Burger is and really has gone and what it's doing, it's like Burger King, Red Robin, White Castle, Qdoba, the sausage for Little Caesars Pizza, Carl's Jr., TGI Fridays, and Del Taco. So what Impossible Burger is doing by being the quote, the representative for plant-based, is going into these places and saying, and giving them a health halo and directing Americans and saying, hey, you should come in here and eat and have this Impossible Burger, when the remainder of everything else that's in there, from the soda to the toppings to the buns to the other product, like to just even the quantities of what is being consumed, has nowhere, you know, doesn't line up at all in a better nutrition for better health messaging. So again, if you want to pop into Burger King, you know, once in a blue moon, and literally when the moon is blue, like by all means, or if you want to, you know, I'm here in Columbus, Ohio, hit a White Castle for a slider, like, you know, once a year, great. But I don't see it as something that we should be doing on a regular basis. Lot of concerns there. So let's move over to the Beyond Burger, because I think it brings up some of the other things, Robin, that you were talking about. So what the two burgers share in common is that they both start off with water as the first ingredient. So they are doing something better for all of us, and that is helping us to increase our water intake. But the primary distinction is in their protein sources. And so soy protein concentrate with a little soy protein isolate is the Impossible Burger. And they both are high protein, high fat. So in the Beyond Burger, they're pea protein isolate. Now, pea protein is enjoying that moment that soy enjoyed, you know, back in the probably 70s and 80s, that rice protein then enjoyed, that, I mean, we've seen it with all these different proteins. But pea protein, we don't know a lot about. We don't know, and I'd love for you to talk about the monocropping and the allergen component. And the one thing that I'll just nod to as I kick it over to you is, we do have to, with any protein source, but especially one grown from the ground, we've got to wonder about heavy metals. Now, when they're growing it and then processing it, they may be able to extract and be aware of those heavy metals. But I'm always concerned when I'm looking at protein powders and things like that. I want to make sure that we're, you know, looking at that part. So I'm concerned about if my patients start consistently from their their non-dairy milks to their bars to their protein powders to now their burgers and their cheeses consuming soy protein, what the allergen potential could be for that. And so I'd love to hear from you what your thoughts are on that piece, and also environmentally what pea protein as a monocrop means for our farmers.
Well, I will say that one thing that Americans tend not to do is anything in moderation when it comes to food. And one of my concerns around the frenzy around the pea protein is that the two key agricultural giants that are behind it are ADM and Cargill. And when you step back and you say, okay, you know, the same players that brought us soy are now bringing us pea. The commoditization of the soy crop absolutely has destroyed soil health. It's done a lot to damage the environment and the climate. So commoditizing the pea is going to do the same thing. You know, there's no silver bullet. And I think sometimes we hope that there's going to be some quick and easy answer. The answer to solving the climate crisis and the answer to solving the environmental crisis is biodiversity. These same farmers that we were with last week said, you know, biodiversity is my crop insurance. And what that means is you're planting a rotation and a bunch of different crops. And my concern is the sort of all-in approach that we tend to take. And it's all consuming right now. This space is sucking up so much capital that should be going into the farming infrastructure and the farming economy. It's sucking up so much that, you know, we're sort of looking at it as like, hey, there's a silver bullet. Oh my gosh, look over here. It's the silver bullet. That's my concern. Monocropping the pea is not going to solve the biodiversity problem. Monocropping the pea is also not going to solve for the climate crisis. Do we need to get back to some semblance of moderation? Absolutely. But I think the conversation is more about meat reduction than on these processed fake meat patties. And when I first saw the pea protein start to sort of inch its way into the vernacular in the conversation, my absolute first thought, always because of how my work started, is that not enough people realize that the pea protein, because it's part of the legume family, can be cross-reactive with the peanut. And so, you know, I know this very closely firsthand from my godson and my nephew. He is deathly allergic to the legume family. So we're talking about chickpeas, peas, and also the peanut. And so my concern is that somebody would think, again, that this product has a health halo, have absolutely no idea about the cross-reactivity between the pea protein and the peanut, and could go into some kind of a reaction, not even aware of what's causing it. And so, you know, always for me, that's my first concern. And, you know, pea protein does, the pea plant plays a healthy role in the crop rotation, in the biodiversity. My concern is that when you've got these two key players, ADM and Cargill, behind this thing, you know, Cargill's not just investing in these plant-based burgers, they're also investing in the cell-based burgers. And so, you know, you kind of got to step back and say, okay, let's look at the players. Let's look at their incentives. What are the motives here? And then you got to step back and say, okay, what are the motives for my family? You know, any parent out there, the first concern is for the health of their children. And like you said, these products are loaded with fat and salt. And just the profile of that alone is something that you would use very much in moderation should you be feeding your family. So I think it's really important to step back and start to have these conversations and ask these harder questions. It was John F. Kennedy who said, the great enemy of truth is very often not the lie, but the myth. And I think what we really need to be examining here is the myth.
Oh, so well said. Part of me feels like we should end it on John F. Kennedy, and then part of me still has more that I want to talk about. So I think I just want to, you know, on this piece, I think that where we came in was really talking about the numbers in plant-based. And so what I want to do is talk about the fact that in plant-based, in the plant-based space, we may have junk food, right? Like we may have, so if going out to some of these fast food places that I was mentioning before was something that you did on occasion for junk food, that's something that, you know, or you're in an airport or whatever, it's on an occasional basis, that isn't something that is going to negatively impact your health likely. But I think what we really need to understand as we're looking at the whole plant-based space, and this goes to the milk and the dairy conversation, is that a plant-based, there are lazy, poor quality plant-based food or plant-based nutrition plans. And just because they are plant-based, that's like probably the biggest myth. They can be plant-based piled on, you know, but hyper-processed and super junky, you know, with a little bit of sauce on top, right? And full disclosure, I will eat a Beyond Burger. I do not eat an Impossible Burger. I actually find for me that a Beyond Burger every once in a while, like since I don't eat a burger, like really does the trick and I enjoy it. And I had my friend made it the other day, and it was like so amazing. She had it in on a bed of greens, and then we did sauteed mushrooms and onions, and we had a cashew cheese on there and a mustard, and I don't even know, like 16 different spices. So in that instance, the Beyond Burger was the non-health food, but everything else there, it was an enabler for me to be eating really good stuff. And also, by the way, it kept me from having, like, that was my, like, I'm craving something junky, here's what I'm going to have. But I think the concern that I have is where we're what we're doing is targeting or bringing these into a plant-based plan that isn't around whole food plants from a better nutrition standpoint. You know, we're not saying like, don't have your fries and your burger or two patties or your high protein, high fat. Instead, we're saying totally have it, but have it from processed plants. And I think that, you know, whether you're a science geek and you're saying like, hey, where's the research on that? The research is on there. You know, when you look at the Mediterranean diet, is not focusing on saying that all meat is bad for you. It's just meat less, plants more. And I think that part of what you were talking about, you know, really being aspirational is, you know, so unbelievably important. So I think when we come round on all of this piece, you know, for me, the key thing for us to all collaborate on is really looking at what would be better for farmers. And I think you have your pulse on that so wholeheartedly, because a big part of that is also what would be better for our soil. And I want to make sure that we include that as part of this discussion, because we can't just be talking about the end product and what we're eating if we're, and I don't even think it's just a climate addressing issue. It's an issue of addressing our current health and the health that we are, you know, the current human health at any age of anyone who's alive today. Because when you look at our current soil, it literally maps out what is missing from our current soil, maps out the nutrients that are missing and or that are that lack of or excess or imbalance of is implicated in the diseases that we have today. So bringing that round to the soil conversation that you were having with farmers, what would be better for them from a soil health standpoint?
Wow, that's a great question. And again, I think, you know, the farmer in Nebraska that said biodiversity is my crop insurance, nailed it. Because when you step back and you look at the farming system in America, the farmers are able to get access to crop insurance based on the prior 10 years or so of data. So they're basically being compensated for what they did in the past. And one of the challenges farmers have today, if they want to convert their farmland to organic practices, is the data obviously is not there because they're literally in that conversion process. So therefore, they have a much harder time securing access to crop insurance. And it becomes a risk profile, you know, that you're dealing with. You know, how risky is this transition? And so one of the things that we're focusing on with Replant Capital is how do we mitigate that risk for the farmer? How can they have access not only to a lower cost of capital, but where could those insurance programs come from? And it's fascinating because a lot of people are having those conversations right now. And the reason that farmers are actually asking for regenerative farming, because it's not necessarily coming from the consumer, is because what you touched on earlier is that they see this massive decline in soil health. They realize that the soil is no longer able to provide the yields that it was providing because of how it's been treated over the last 10 or 20 years. And they're realizing that all these inputs that they've been having to purchase and apply to their crops, things like glyphosate, the insecticides, the fungicides, the fertilizers, all of these inputs, not only are they enormously expensive to the farmer, but they're also realizing the impact that it started to have on the soil. And the farmers themselves will tell you, gosh, I never would have expected by just simply getting rid of some of these inputs and some of these fertilizers and some of these weed killers like glyphosate, what difference I might see in soil health. And so it's a much bigger conversation. And to me, capital is the most important ingredient in our food system. We ignore that, but it is absolutely the most important ingredient in the food system. And so you have to ask, where is it coming from? It's coming from ADM and Cargill very much largely in this space. And those are the same companies that we are having to reckon with right now, who have absolutely deforested the planet and destroyed so much of this. So it's where you kind of step back and say, these guys have done a brilliant job of manufacturing demand for these products, but who are the partners here? And what are the track records here? And I think that's a really important conversation. And I guess where I land on it right now is I am always, always for innovation. I am always for disruption. And I very much appreciate that these companies have created a global conversation around the need to reduce meat consumption. But I do believe that they are answering a they're providing some answer to a question that nobody asked. And we were not asking for junky fake meat products from a lab. Nobody was asking for that. What we were asking is, what role can we play in helping to heal the health of the planet? What role can we play as consumers in helping to heal the health of the soil? What role can we play? Is eating meat from a lab going to do that? And what is the impact of that going to be on my own health, on my children's health, on my family's health? So to really step back, I mean, these are big, really important conversations. And anytime you have a new category that launches, it's usually the first few companies, the first few products in that category aren't going to end up being the best. And it's interesting to see the conversations that are happening with leaders in the industry as these big players start to step in. You know, you have Tyson's Foods stepping in. I mean, they've been investors in some of these companies they've recently pulled out. Nestle's another one. You know, they stepped into this company they've recently pulled out. Again, these are the processed food giants that are stepping into this. These are the meat giants that are stepping into this. Is this the answer? I think the answer to that remains to be seen.
Yeah. And, you know, you actually brought something in there that I think is you brought a ton in there that we want to unpack and focus on. But somebody asked me the other day, they were like, well, the Impossible Burger is not good, right? Because it's not organic. And I was like, look, you, if that product was organic, it was, if I had read you the ingredient label and it was the exact same ingredients, but it was all organic, I still would tell you that there's no health value to that. And I think that that's a really important piece. And yes, somebody will argue with me, well, you know, we need organic or we need protein, and soy protein concentrate, if it's organic, is much better for us. You know, I would say we've really inflated our needs of protein. And I think that if you blended some nuts, seeds, including, and beans, including soybeans together, we could have something equally delicious, probably a better nutrient profile, because I think some carbohydrates do pretty well for the majority of us. And, you know, I think on that part, so organic is not just the answer in that part. And you also mentioned something too about who are the companies involved in it. I'm just going to stand on my soapbox because it's our podcast, and I'm just going to say something because I think a lot of people who listen to our podcast, they've been chimed in before, and I thank you for listening, are people who are either themselves investors or in the food space. You know, of late, so I've had wonderful experiences where I've been able to be or attend events where there are these great forums for discussing the future of plant-based protein. I've participated in some, so I was really grateful when Milken Institute had me with Ethan from Beyond Meat, and we had someone from Memphis Meats. I'm just blocking on his name, so I apologize. And then also CEO at the time from Tyson Foods. And they brought me on board because they said, we can't have a conversation about plant-based proteins and not have a healthcare practitioner. Well, recently, there are about three or four different investor conversations that I've gotten notifications about. And one of the things that I think is really dangerous that's happening in this space is you have the investors and you have the company founders who are all talking about the science and sharing nutrition messages and marketing messages, you know, on the company side about the health value of these products and their marketing messages. And so as somebody who started my career off selling you America sugared cereals and telling you how good they are for you, we did a really good job of that. You know, we told you that the perfect breakfast, you know, was a carb bomb, a bowl of cereal, milk, juice, fruit, toast with jelly on top of it. So I think we have to be really careful right now. So one of the things that I would like to say to anyone who's putting one of those conversations together, to Robin's point, we love those conversations. We think that the innovation that we have right now to hit on flavor has figured certain things out, appearance figured other. So we're really excited to see what these future innovations have to hold. But we also have to make sure that the experts, the people who are on the front lines of implementing, not just understanding what the science is, but also implementing that and seeing the health impact with their patients, are involved in these conversations. Because I think, you know, a lot of what I speak about here, when I broke down what the health issues are with these two different, my health concerns with these two different products, and the fact that there is no winner. The winner would be broccoli or a delicious homemade, version of a quality vegetable burger. So I think we have to make sure that we include health experts in these conversations. And I would, you know, love to see more of that happening as we move these innovations forward as well.
We really are in a period of just rapid evolution in the food industry, and it's been driven by so many different factors. I mean, as you know so well, I came into it because of the food allergy space and just seeing the jaw-dropping number of people that are impacted by these things. So to me, the cross-reactivity with pea protein is definitely something that people need to know about if they also have a peanut allergy or have a child with peanut allergy. The environmental impact and the way that we grow our meat and CAFOs, I mean, those are hugely important conversations. People often say it's the how, not the cow. And so, you know, to really step back and say environmentally, what is the impact of the way that we are processing our meat? Again, what is the health impact of the way that we are processing our fake meat? These are really important conversations that need to be tabled now before we inadvertently create some other kind of health issue that we may not be aware of going into these things again, because especially when you think about Impossible and the products and the ingredients that are in those products, the long-term health impacts are not yet known. So to step back and say, let's have these conversations, recognizing, you know, we've got some publicly traded companies in there now. There are a lot of shareholders that are only going to want to see that thing go up. Unfortunately, meat reduction doesn't have those same shareholders that are going to be fighting as hard as they can to make sure that that impact is also seen. So these are huge conversations, and I think they're critically important. The innovation absolutely has to continue. I will sit with the fact that these are the first products on the market in this category, and there's going to be a lot of innovation to follow. The big food companies are not going to sit there and let them just suck up all of the capital. So there will be continued iteration. I guarantee the big companies are listening to this conversation right now, Ashley, and they will be mindful of the health profile of their products as they move forward, because I do think that these products carry a health halo that they haven't yet earned. Can they earn it? Absolutely. But where it is right now, as you so beautifully detailed earlier in the show, it's not there yet.
Yeah. And it is, like, we've had veggie burgers. You know, we had the whole issue of the hexane washing and the soy burger. I mean, I was a vegan. You know, I remember thinking, like, oh, my gosh, this is the greatest thing ever, like, back in the day. And so there are parts where I also think we're in a new innovation space with these particular burgers. But I also think that I'm harping more on the Impossible Burger, because I think the pea protein issue we haven't seen that there is the issue that we are both concerned about, you know, and certainly the monocropping issue and what the soil and the diversity, like, I don't want to understate how important that is. But we have been down this field with the soy and with this part. And I just think that there's so much, it makes me frustrated with the big companies. And as you mentioned before, with Gates and some of these others who are investing in this instead of looking at what we could be doing. You know, they're just amazing things that are going on with lentils and, you know, all these other grains and beans and, you know, so, and maybe they're investing in those as well. So I will just believe that maybe they're just spreading across a lot of different plant-based things to figure out what is going to stick. But for those of you who are listening and focused solely on your own health, I just want to wrap up with, on my end, what I would say is I personally, and for my patients, I believe that the Beyond Burger is an option. I do not believe that the Impossible Burger or the Impossible Sausage to be coming, if it has a similar profile to the Impossible Burger current, is an option for better health. I think at a it's a slippery slope in terms of how much of this are you incorporating in. So, I have a patient who said she's having the sausage, Beyond sausages on one day, she's having the Beyond Burger on a different, she's got the crumbles on another day. And we talked about food and how she could use hemp seeds as the crumbles, or she could do, cauliflower. We just have gone through other, blends of nuts and seeds and just different things. So just avoid making this something that is dominant. I know that's not what anyone who is a part of the IPO wants to hear. But I feel like if the role of Beyond Meat is to offer, if there are a lot more mouths globally that get a little of this, then I think there could be value. I just don't want your mouth to be getting a lot of it from a health standpoint.
Yeah, I think that's probably why the alarm bells were going off for both of us, is that we were both brought into the work because our primary focus was on the health of our country. And you always say Team USA, and we can't tackle the health of the environment in isolation. We have to look at these two things as parallel tracks, like a railroad. And you can be addressing these environmental health impacts, but not unmindful of the health impact on the consumer. And so while I appreciate that they're reaching for that first rail, you can't do it without also addressing the second rail. The health of our country is in such a precarious place right now, and it's impacting our economy in such a massive way with obesity and diabetes and pediatric cancers and all these different concerns that we touch on every single day. And these are two parallel tracks that need to be run together. And while I enormously appreciate the focus of the environmental impact, to ignore the health impact of a product to me is irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there you have it, in the plant-based burger wars, and we didn't even touch cell culturing. So there are so many other conversations. In the plant-based burger wars, we don't really have a winner for you. And unfortunately, I think we're both concerned about whether there's a win for the country at all in this space. But to be continued, and we really look forward to your thoughts. So if you are grabbing this podcast and you can share a message with us, if you liked what you heard or can share a review, we would really appreciate that on wherever you're listening to the podcast. But you can also grab Robin and I on our social media where we're sharing this. And if you have any questions or thoughts that you would like us to entertain as part of this conversation, please send them over to us as well. And we are so looking forward to our next podcast discussion with someone who is just amazing to both of us, and we'll be talking a lot about fruits and vegetables. So please make sure that you subscribe so that you can get that podcast as well. So thank you.
Thank you, ladies. Another great podcast as always. Just so much information. I feel as though Ashley and Robin could speak for 3 hours and still have an abundance of information to give us. Perfect podcast as always, as far as I'm concerned. Right. On to our next podcast, Elizabeth Nardi will be on the show. She's the CEO at Organically Grown Company. The company was founded in 1978 by a few gardeners, small-scale farmers, hippies, environmental activists, and dreamers living near Eugene, Oregon. And today, Organically Grown Company buys, aggregates, and distributes fresh, organically grown produce to retailers and eateries. Wow, she's going to have a lot to say. I'm always so intrigued by the organic section. I only buy organic when I can. I know Ashley's a big advocate of buying organic food. So looking forward to it. Looking forward to hearing the benefits of it. And yeah. All right, everyone. It was great to have you aboard as always. And until next time, I'll see you then.